It's Sunday, which means it's time for Viewpoint Presents with Malcolm and Michael Johns. Each week, we bring you the top global and national news stories presented with facts and top-tier analysis, all from a perspective rooted in America's founding principles. Join us in defending our great nation and American liberty. Now, here's Malcolm and Michael with the week's top stories.
Well, the Senate Homeland Security and Finance Committees, just this past week, around Wednesday there, they released an interim report on, well, Hunter Biden and his involvement in the Burisma scandal that is really bubbling up here big time. And, you know, this thing goes so deep, you can't even begin. I mean, it actually blows your mind when you start to look at this whole thing here. And what the committee has already revealed is quite striking. This is a story I would suggest to you that would be on every network at the beginning of every program. It would be in every newspaper. It would be, I'm telling you, my fellow Americans, it would be the biggest story because, you know, this really is what you would call collusion. And it's actually more than collusion. They're actually looking at criminal charges. So let's start there. And if that isn't enough for you, we're going to do that story justice today here. Welcome to Viewpoint Presents. This is Malcolm along with Michael Johns. And we have a lot of different stories to cover with you today. We'll start on that. We'll talk about some of these ballots and the election concerns that are happening here as, you know, this election is really getting hot and heavy, as you know, here. It's like, you know, anything goes right at this point. And then again, the Senate is top up on the list here. Can the Republicans retain the Senate? There's a lot of interesting seats in there to talk about. This one's a little tricky right now. It depends upon, you've got the down ballot thing that is going to be a big deal here with the Senate and the momentum. If the Republicans have hope of keeping that, they're going to have to really score on all levers, I think, here. Let's start right here now again with the Hunter Biden Burisma thing. And Michael, this is really something else. The more I look at this story, and I don't think most Americans really understand what's happened here. But, you know, what gets me on this whole thing is all this time we spent in talking about the word collusion and, of course, the Russia business and the president, Trump, which never existed, was clearly shown. Here is a story that everybody is trying to look the other way. And I think the real glaring problem that I'm seeing right now is that, and I think everybody should have the sense, the election is running fast now, and it's going to run out before some of these investigations come to a head. I think that's the biggest concern I have. How do you feel this thing comes to any kind of conclusion, Michael, between now and election and what happens?
Well, this, like almost every issue that we're confronting with Obama-Biden era corruption and policy disasters, sort of the reality of the situation, which we're attempting to communicate best that we can, and then there's the reality of how they're handled by the Department of Justice and FBI, and how they're ultimately interpreted politically and by the American people, and do they in fact actually get this news? So, you know, in this case, we have son of the Democrat nominee for president of the United States, who the Senate Homeland Security and Finance Committee reported this week. I mean, this was an exhaustive report, Malcolm, 45,000 pages of documents reviewed. They'd interviewed an abundant number of witnesses, 87 pages in total, really almost worth reading. I would refer it to people. But the conclusion was essentially that Hunter Biden, son of Joe Biden, had leveraged his last name and relationship with the then vice president to extract millions of dollars from not just questionable and corrupt sources, but even hostile powers. So you had the Burisma issue in Ukraine. Burisma was a corrupt energy company in Ukraine that was under investigation by the Ukrainian government. The U.S. government also viewed it critically and skeptically. He was placed on the board there at $50,000 a month retainer with zero experience in energy and zero experience in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And during that time, this report comes out with even new information that repeatedly, both from the embassy in Kiev and from other sources in the U.S. government, Joe Biden was personally notified that Hunter's presence on this board was actually impeding, obstructing, and making it difficult for the U.S. to pursue its anti-corruption policy agenda in Ukraine, which was one of the top policy agendas in that country at the time. So literally, it had an opportunity to come off of the board so that U.S. policy interests could be pursued successfully. Instead, he was kept on there and put his personal wealth and personal financial opportunities above U.S. policy interests.
Yeah. Now, George Kent is he was the deputy chief of mission at the U.S. embassy right there, Michael. And he says this. So listen, and to your point just now that you make here, there not only were there a lot of warning signs, but there were a lot of people who spoke up about this to the Obama administration. I mean, what one of the things this report shows is it's not an accident. They clearly knew. And for everybody to look now at each other and turn the other way and say, well, we didn't really know any of this was going on and sort of who's throwing who under the bus. But listen to these words, this quote here from Kent here, George Kent. He says, the presence of Hunter Biden on the Burisma board was very awkward for all U.S. officials pushing an anti-corruption agenda in the Ukraine. I mean, he put it right out there, and the testimony shows there were a lot of people who went to the sources and said, you know, that to the Obama administration and said that this is not the way to do this. This is wrong. Yet here's the thing, Michael, that let's get right to it. And here's the thing. They kept looking the other way. And I think the reason they did this, I'm going to suggest to you, and it's just a guess on my end, is because this is one of the best get rich quick schemes I've seen, better than winning the Grand Slam in a great grand old Monopoly game here. This thing, the money they pulled down from this thing was worth it. It was a gamble, basically. I don't think he was planning at that point Biden running for president or thinking that would even happen, remember, because they were, this is goes back then when, you know, prior to Trump coming even on the scene here, was Hillary Clinton was going right to be the apparent royal. So I think they took their chances, Michael. I mean, when you look at the kind of dollars they took down, I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands and
I'm up in the 10 million range already, and I think there's a good number of other issues and funding right that wasn't even counted here. So what's important is, you know, you look outrageously at Obama, you know, bragging that they had no major scandals. Really, almost certainly the most scandalous government since Nixon. The whole Hillary Clinton management, both in the emails and the Clinton Foundation, which was kind of the model that it appears Hunter Biden sort of tried to leverage, essentially selling
pay
off
to play
policy, pay to play, basically. You know, you put money into, you know, leaders in the Obama-Biden administration and you'll kind of get what you want. So in fact, the corruption investigation into Burisma and in Ukraine went nowhere. And famously, Joe Biden in that Council on Foreign Relations speech came forward and, you know, he was openly saying that he said, we're not releasing U.S. aid to Ukraine until the prosecutor involved in that is fired. And the prosecutor, in fact, as he says in that, was fired. I think it might be helpful. I have just a segment from the report, which I think gets really to the heart of it, because it's, I think, you know, as far as government reports go on criminal matters, this is very straightforward. The Treasury, this is, quote, the Treasury records acquired by the chairmans show potential criminal activity relating to transactions among and between Hunter Biden, his family, and his associates with the Ukrainian, Russian, Kazakh, and Chinese nationals. In particular, these documents show that Hunter Biden received millions of dollars from foreign sources as a result of business relationships that he built during the period when his father was vice president of the United States and after. So in essence, there's at least three components here of this scandal, which importantly, and to his credit, Senator Rand Paul has already referred to the Department of Justice for criminal investigation. We covered the Ukraine part with Burisma, which actually had been out there for quite a while. New information, however, $3.5 million sent to Hunter Biden from the wife of the mayor of Moscow.
Yeah.
In as part of a you know what appears to be another pay-to-play like scheme. And,
well, let me jump in here. Hold on. Now, that what you're speaking about right now, that $3.5 million, by the way, that was to Rosemont Seneca Thornton. That's an investment firm. And guess
that's
what?
That's a firm that he was a
co-founded
partner,
by Hunter Biden. Yeah, yeah, co-founded by Hunter Biden. Michael, let me ask you some about that $3.5 million here, please, that went to their to the investment firm that was co-founded by Hunter Biden. So if you're going to do something like that, what does that possibly say? I mean, they never were thinking in a million years that Joe Biden was going to run for another high office. I mean, they took a chance. I mean, talk to me. I mean, didn't they just take a gamble based on that was easy money at that point, not thinking he was ever going to run? Is that right or is that wrong?
I keep thinking of the Osama bin Laden reports that were found in the compound where he was killed, where he had apparently written that the assassination of Obama would be positive because Biden was so incompetent and corruptible and easy to deal with. Mm-hmm. I think around the world, I mean, literally around the world, this guy had a reputation of not standing up for U.S. interests. You and I have talked about that in broad policy ways, but now we're seeing that, you know, literally personal self-enrichment apparently
Michael,
was a vastly higher priority.
How juicy is that? Listen to what you just said.
It's huge, and yet I got to tell you, the day after this report, this great Senate report comes out, very credible Senator Ron Johnson, who I know you've had a chance to interview before.
Straight shooter.
Did a real great job on this, and he's not an overtly partisan guy. He's, you know, looking for normalcy and ethics in government.
Amen.
And, you know, really almost to your point, no, like not really any like really significant mainstream media coverage. I mean, it's all out there for someone who wants to, you know, kind of get to the heart of it. But, you know, if this had been done by Jared Kushner or Monica Trump, just imagine the circumstances were that there was a $3.5 million, you know, deposit from the mayor of Moscow into Ivanka Trump's account. Do you think there would have been no media coverage next day? Would there not be media coverage? You have an FBI investigation, you have congressional hearings. There wouldn't be any. The whole country would come to a full stop until we had an answer about what was going on.
Michael, it would be a full stop and they'd have them in handcuffs by now.
I also want to point out that this report serves a very constructive end because it unearthed this relationship with Russia. And of course, anyone who's, you know, I've been to Russia, anyone who's been over there realizes it's, you know, a very sort of closed society where business is done on relationships within the party and within the government structure. Very little happens outside of that that's given free rein. The same and even more so in some ways with the Communist Party of China, which, hey, by the way, he also had a very lucrative relationship. He started a fund and had many millions of dollars invested into this from Chinese Communist Party owned businesses and including a Chinese Communist Party controlled financial institutions, the Postal Savings Bank, the Bank of China, and others, all of which poured money in. Not only that, they'd afforded him a line of credit. When you look at the actual description of it, there's like no real like explanation of the basis for this massive line of credit, and it actually was afforded to other Biden family members who weren't even involved immediately in this China related operation. China, as I've mentioned to you before, and its government, as evil as it is in so many ways with its human rights violations and other activities, its theft, it's an extremely strategically minded and intelligent government. And again, I think it points to the fact that they saw the weak point here in the Obama administration. It was the guy sitting in the number two job in that administration.
I mean, this is unreal. And I have a question for you in a moment here, but playing to what you're talking about with the Chinese here, as I read in the report, it said that Hunter Biden had these business associations, as you're saying, with the Chinese nationals, but just the government and the People's Liberation Army. But specifically, it says here, those associations resulted in millions of dollars in cash flow. We don't even know how much that is, Michael, but we're talking millions of dollars. And they opened up a bank account to fund this global spending spree with Joe Biden's brother, James Biden, and the wife, Sarah Biden, Michael. This was an all in the family kind of event.
Yeah, you know, uncle and his wife. Right.
Yeah, I mean, they're all involved and they're in this thing. So let me ask you this.
They refer to a $100,000 spending spree that was utilized on that line of credit. They actually used the phrase spending spree. These are not, by the way, in congressional reports, the sort of phrases you commonly see. Uh-huh. It really points to, I think, the magnitude and the brashness with which this guy and his father, because I think it was all done with his father's recognition and knowledge, carried themselves.
You know, I want to tell you something. Senator Johnson said to me off the mic, and I can say it now because this thing is out, but he said to me off the mic and in between as we were recording there just a few weeks back before this whole thing was happening. I'm just thinking back now, Michael, because this thing is in the heat of it right now and it's heavy, but I could just imagine he was in the heat of it at that moment when he shared with me. He said, Malcolm, he said, you have got to see what went. He made a comment to me. We have got to talk about this ahead, he said. You're not going to believe what we're going to be revealing soon. And he said that to me off mic about what was happening right there before this thing ever came out. And I did an aha and thinking, okay, he's got something, but he didn't say much more. But he said, you're going to be shocked at what you see here, and what finds out in this report. At that point, I wasn't even connecting the dots with all these other things, but this is what he was speaking about right here, Michael. This is it.
Right. And, you know, there was another important component of this report in that the Joe Biden was not the only Obama administration figure who had a relative involved in this. Hunter Biden had forged a partnership with Christopher Hines, who is the son-in-law of John Kerry, who was then Secretary of State. They, in turn, went about pursuing this creation of this fund for high net worth individuals in China, interpretation Chinese Communist Party officials, because not many others there have high net worths. For the purposes of pocketing, you know, many millions of dollars as it relates to this. We've heard from the FBI already about Communist China's essential and extensive efforts at trying to target and infiltrate U.S. institutions. Well, here they had formulated a very concrete relationship with relative of the second most powerful man in the country, now running for president. You might say, hey, this is all boring and there's nothing here that's all that salacious, but the salacious part of it is the fact that there's also outflows of money that went into companies that were perceived to be involved in prostitution and human trafficking rings.
What I hear, yeah.
Yeah, so...
What do you know about that? How serious? How deep?
Nothing more than the report, and that the mother of Hunter Biden's latest child is a stripper, which also doesn't get wildly reported, commonly reported. I think this whole conglomeration of ethics issues related to the Russian investigation, the fake dossier, everything we talked about last episode, and the lack of seriousness that's being brought apparently into prosecutions on that, this Hunter Biden issue, the Clinton Foundation, and even the Hillary Clinton email situation remain paramount. They point to an administration that was not really operating under any set of functional ethical principles and was violating governmental policies and quite possibly and probably violating laws.
Yeah. So listen to what, and when this is all brought up to Hunter Biden, what he ends up saying, I mean, he puts us all under, you know what he says? He doesn't apologize. He doesn't say he says it was poor judgment, Michael. That's what he calls it. Poor judgment. Well, yeah, poor judgment as he was getting rich and the family was getting rich and loaded. You just mentioned when you connected the dots there within the Obama administration. You know, I think about it in these terms now. when you think about how grave all of these, this is, and all of these scandals are, and then you see the gravity of this election right now, to me, the real gravity of 2020 now is to uncover or at least get to the truth of everything that happened during one of the most corrupt periods in our nation's history that we know of, certainly in our modern times. And so that really is, now I get the sense, Michael, this is why they're so, I get the sense why they're so jumpy. And I'm very serious.
Well, and why they don't want to answer any questions. And they don't answer questions on this. Joe Biden was presented with questions as it relates to this. He completely just changes the topic. I mean, literally won't address it. I think the final point on this, two final quick points. One is I was looking through the clients of the Chinese fund that was sent up by Hunter Biden. One guy named Wang Shu, who is the chief propagandist in the People's Liberation Army of China. So to the extent you were going to go out and identify any, you know, sort of singular entity or individual that is defining itself as an enemy of the United States, that would probably be it. And Joe Biden and his son apparently had no problem doing self-serving business with that entity and with that individual. The final thing I want to point out is, as much as I give a lot of props to the committee for coming out with this great report and to Senator Johnson for it, but one of the questions continues to be, you know, it's really the responsibility of the Department of Justice and the FBI to be unearthing these things. These all of these issues are fairly recent, but they are years ago. Where has the Department of Justice and the FBI been as the son of the second most powerful man in the country under the Obama administration was selling his name for millions of dollars in what certainly created policy concerns and maybe many other concerns for the interests of the United States of America?
Well, I'm also wondering, did any of this money, what I'd like to see is if they could take a look at Joe Biden's checking accounts and all of his business affairs. Those should be subpoenaed in question right now, because I'd like to see where the money trail is and where's all that money going. And I'm wondering if some of this money goes back directly to Barack Obama to fund his life, because they've become billionaires times over based on all of these unethical machinations they've been playing with here, Michael. So I think, this thing, I think the real point or question now is the election. I still come back to this election. So let's talk a minute about that. What happens now if this all, looking back election, so if, and I have trouble saying this. I always have trouble saying this. I know other people say it and they don't have a problem, but if Joe Biden was the victor in 2020, I just can't imagine from my wildest dreams, but if he was, what would happen to this investigation and all these others?
Well, I mean, given that the Obama and Biden administration didn't see any basis to launch what should have been a criminal investigation into this, and given that the Trump administration continues to have a Department of Justice that isn't terribly different than the Department of Justice under the Obama administration.
Wow.
Many of the same individuals still there, and plenty of people protecting the Clinton Biden mafia. I would suspect probably very little. And if Republicans don't have control of one of the two bodies of Congress, they would have no ability to pursue really an investigation into this, no subpoena power, nothing of that sort. Another probably structural governmental reform we ought to look at, you know, if you're holding on to the Senate by a seat or two, does the minority all of a sudden lose its ability to look into issues that are of importance to the American people? It seems to me that confines the interests of justice and democratic accountability.
Yeah. Your point of the DOJ, and everybody should understand what this means and the stakes of all this, but your point of the DOJ, this Department of Justice, and their lack of interest in these kinds of things, it goes to the conversations we have all the time, which is really about the establishment and what is really happening across our government. We're looking at just an incredible moment of scandals and things to the point. And, you know, when people use these words, Michael, like deep state establishment kind of thing, I mean, it's very clear every American should be paying attention to what we're talking about right now. And to think that this man now, you couldn't have played this any different. I mean, this is like the best-selling novel of the universe here. To think that now the man at the center of all this through the Obama administration after Hillary was overturned in 2016 is now the poster child for corruptness and sort of like Barney Fife, as you were just talking about a moment ago, a guy that's not respected around the world. He's a bit of a dumb cluck, you know. And he's the man now that the Democrats have as their lead person to try to take it back in 2020. Can you believe we're saying this, actually, how crazy this is?
I totally believe it because, in essence, I was a victim of it. You know, the IRS, under, in my view, Obama's direct direction, targeted our Tea Party movement, literally demanded lists of donors, unethically and illegally audited individuals who had been then affiliated with that, put them through all kinds of costly and problematic federal problems. So I've seen this up front. I saw when they conducted their purported internal investigation, which they took forever to get around to. You couldn't even imagine how much pressure had to be exerted, how they brought senior people in who were literally part of the scandal while they interviewed people to try to obtain the information to make it even more difficult for them to be forthcoming. I saw how Mueller testified before Congress when he was head of FBI and had almost nothing to say or know about it, clearly wasn't addressing it as the priority that it should be. In essence, that was the beginning of the targeting, the spying on political opponents before Obamagate itself, which is defined more as the Russian investigation, began. And we have no closure on that issue, as well as you and I have discussed pretty extensively. And at this point, we're like 40 days out from an election, and the key players involved in that, including Obama, including Biden, including Hillary Clinton, who paid for the dossier, have, as of today at least, still not been interviewed by even one figure within the Department of Justice or FBI.
I mean, I'm doing a double, triple shake of my head with this thing. I mean, it's beyond, you know.
I respect the president, though, and I just, you know, what's most curious to me.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I think you and I both have great degree of respect for President Trump, that he wants justice, and I just wonder what level of frustration or lack thereof he's operating on, seeing that all of this criminality has occurred, that he is the president of the United States and has some degree, a great degree of ability to ensure that justice is administered. And 40 days away from the election, we really have held almost no one from that administration accountable for their actions. Yeah.
Think about the pressure with everything you just said. That just sums it up beautifully. Think about the pressure, everybody, about, again, what President Trump, number 45, is going through in the Oval Office with what Michael says there. That's, I mean, just put that in perspective a moment, please. A guy who really put his soul and his heart on the line for the country, Michael, really and truly he did. And, you know, I have great respect for what he's gone through. And now for him to be seeing all of this and knowing that the clock is there. And, you know, I get the sense, Michael, he's working double, triple time, overtime, trying to really appeal to the American people. I mean, we're in for an interesting few years. And I'm going to tell you, God help us, that the Republicans can not only that Donald Trump can maintain the presidency, of course, but that the Senate stays in the hands of the Republicans. And if the House would, if we could take that back, do you realize the kind of success and the kind of damage control we could accomplish potentially in the next 4 years would be significant, Michael?
It's unbelievable. Huge. It's bringing me back to 2009, when, you know, essentially the whole world looked completely bleak to the majority, to I think half the country or more. The only good news is that the track record was one of great success. The American people rose to the occasion. What I'm asking now, what I think you're asking as well, is I don't doubt our ability, even against great odds, to take this country back in the event of an unfortunate development in November. But let's not go through that. I mean, we cannot empower these corrupt, hugely politicized, not interested in negotiating, not interested in anything policy related Democrats into positions of authority for 4 years and expect that you're going to recognize this country 4 years from now.
Yeah.
You won't.
Yeah, my brother, I love what you say there. When you say that, you've never said it any better than what you just said. We'll roll back the tape later and listen in, but that was perfectly said. With a mode of optimism, but a mode of realism of what we're dealing with here. So that really is the message here, friends. And finally, in this report, to say the least, like I'm telling you anything, it definitely questions Joe Biden's leadership role. And one last quote here says, Biden's unwillingness to confront a man whom State Department officials considered to be an odious oligarch demonstrated a lack of leadership. There it is right there. Raises serious questions about, presidential candidate now and former Vice President Biden. Well, I'll tell you what, people, it's one for the books here at this point. What a great piece of segment here with Michael on this one here. You see what we're telling you now and the way we position this thing. And this is what the importance of this election is. I just can't stress it any more than that. But now you know the corruption. And big kudos again to this committee. Senator Ron Johnson is an amazing, Michael described him perfectly just moments ago here. He really is, I believe, a first-class gentleman in many, many regards and is out to do the right thing. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick pause here. And we'll come back, talk a little bit more about these election and ballots. You see some of the things that, again, President Trump has been warning about and many, many leaders actually is actually starting to hit many of the wires and the news wires about some of these scandals here. Wow. I tell you, all of this plays again to more drama coming into the election. We'll pick all that up next, my friends, just after this pause. More Viewpoint Presents.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. So with everything we just laid out there, again, with this election, and you see the seriousness of it, and I think that's what everybody should really pay attention to, is that the clock is ticking and the stakes are incredibly high. And as Michael was just pointing out, myself, we are praying that this is a moment of truth for our nation, and that we can get to the other side of these many, many hurdles that we're dealing with here. Let's talk about the election next a little bit, friends. And you've been hearing a lot about the universal mail-in voting, and you've been hearing about the absentee ballots of voting. And of course, that's already started. People are already voting, let's be clear. And we're already seeing some of the problems that certainly President Trump has been warning about and others have. And there are many situations of this that are already playing out. You see in Pennsylvania, they had 9 mailed in military ballots that have been discarded by the local election office. And this, of course, is one of the swing counties of the and they were all for President Trump, coincidentally or not coincidentally, Michael. They were all in there. And then let me just add this point to you, and I'm sure you got a lot to this, but there were more than 1,000 Virginia voters who got 2 ballots. They got a whole round of another ballots going out here. And they tried to quickly correct that and apologize for that in Virginia. The point is, it's not a perfect system. It's not a perfect situation. To me, that's the lesson here. And the more that you open those floodgates with all these states and you let them all go universal mail-in ballot, you're in kind of all kinds of situations. What are you finding, Michael?
Yeah, not a perfect system, Malcolm. I would actually go further. I would say the history of mail-in voting in this country is one of systematic error and fraud. And that's what's, I think, one of the things that's most frustrating. I'm sure it's been frustrating to you as well, watching the debate over this, is that as soon as many of us in the Trump supporting and conservative camp pointed out the history of these errors, immediately, it wasn't as if the media attempted to temper them a little bit or say, yeah, there's been some issues, but here's why it's not a problem. They've completely denied it. So, I mean, you would find an abundant amount of media coverage out there with them saying, here's why, you know, Trump supporters are completely wrong and the campaign's completely wrong in saying that there's any problem with mail-in voting. And of course, historically, you know, just about every place that's been tried, there's been issues. And we've talked about it conceptually, but now we're beyond the conceptual point.
That's right.
We're into an actual election where votes are now being cast in certain states. So, yeah, I thought I'd take a little bit of a look at how it's going in some of these places. You mentioned Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. A bunch of ballots opened improperly in Middle District of Pennsylvania, Virginia, 1,400 voters received duplicate absentee ballots.
Yeah.
This happened in Fairfax County, which is in Northern Virginia, and Henrico County, which is down by Richmond. Postal Service asked, hey, what happened? What happened here by media? Clerical errors was their response.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this is American democracy. This is the future of the country and the world on the line. They inadvertently mailed them out, Fairfax County said. Same problem in the city of Richmond. Paterson, New Jersey had its entire primary done by mail-in ballots. Four residents charged with criminal election fraud, including a councilman and a councilman-elect. One in five ballots in that election, Malcolm, were rejected for signature or other technical problems. So you might look at Paterson, New Jersey and say, well, that's, you know, kind of an aberration. That's just one town. But if, you know, if you look at the New York State primary, mm-hmm. About the same ratio, Malcolm, one in five votes rejected over signature or other technical issues. And that's 20% of the vote. And realize we're dealing with, in President Trump, a candidate who, you know, had about 80,000 votes in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin in 2016 gone the other way, we'd be, you know, talking about President Clinton. There's no real reason to believe that a good number of these states are not going to be equally close. And we're talking about an error rate, a run rate error rate of about 20%. Wisconsin and Maryland, same issue. Not ballots aren't being received on time, so they're being mailed out. But by the time the recipients get them, there's not enough time for them to meet the postmark obligation for them to be counted. Postal Service said, you know, basically, we don't know what happened. I'm sorry, basically. historically, if you look at the last, you know, I want to just quickly take on this mainstream media position that there's not issues with mail-in ballots and just give you factual statistics, which I think is the way to look at it. Last four elections, 2.7 million mail-in ballots were misdelivered and 1.3 million were rejected over these technical and signature issues. And of course, those are the ones that are reported. You know, imagine you don't get your ballot.
That's exactly.
And
yeah.
You know, what percentage of people don't get their ballot and actually take the initiative of calling up, some state authority and actually reporting it, probably a fraction, maybe even a small fraction. So it's likely considerably worse. And if you imagine this on a national level, you think about the fact that there were, 130 million voters in 2016, probably higher in 2020 by every estimate. If you just double that, you know, you figure that the ballot being mailed out, the ballot being mailed back, it's 260 million pieces of mail with a post office that does not have a too much of an impeccable record in either accuracy or timely delivery of mail. So I think we have really a considerable issue here. CBS this morning did a interesting little mock attempt to sort of see how it worked from their end. So this is a mainstream media outlet. Week after initial ballots were sent, most of the ballots were still had not been received. 3% of them never arrived. The post offices, boxes that they set up for this had misdelivered mail, including a birthday card addressed to someone else. They inquired with the post office about where these ballots were when they hadn't been received. The response was, quote, they had them somewhere else, unquote. So I went around the world working with the International Republican Institute, telling foreign governments and officials and political politicians and political aspirants about how to run a free and fair election. And simultaneously, over the last 20 years, I've watched as our elections have become less free and less fair. We got to get arms around this. And I don't know where this whole thing's headed in November 3, but I'll tell you one thing for sure, a good amount of it's going to end up in the courts, because I don't care which side of it you're on. If you're victimized by these sort of issues, with the presidency of the United States on the involved, you're going to be in the court. And like I said to you, I think when we started discussing this last week, which was before this, I believe before the Supreme Court opening, these will most certainly, most of them would likely go to the D.C. Circuit of Court, and the appeal from there would go to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Well, the one thing I notice about all of this is that when the left, you know, when they don't play fear or they don't feel like they can win, then they resort to procedure things. And this is exactly what this voting thing is. I mean, it's not like they can put their policies out there right away, Michael, and like everybody's going to like, oh, man, yeah, let's vote for all that, because that's like the best stuff ever. So they don't really run on policy. In fact, right now with Joe Biden, in fact, you're really seeing no policy. You're seeing no impact at all from this candidate. I mean, it's like he's not even a candidate. It's quite frankly, I'll go a step further. It's almost like Donald Trump is running against the Ghostbuster candidate, or a ghost of some sort, because he's never around. There's no context to the argument. There's no policy. And so what happens is, I think what's happened here in the grand scheme of things, the Democrats knew it was going to play out this way. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Ginsburg has always been questionable, her death. I mean, for a while, it's been reported for months now that she was very, very ill. And we knew that could happen any time. But I think they played the odds on all this. If you really think back, you know, months ago when all this voting stuff started being talked about, I think they realized that they were going to have a hell of a time trying to squeak out a victory. And so now you look at all of these problems, like the pandemic and like the civil unrest, and you see they don't support law enforcement, and they want to defund the police, and they want to wear masks, and they want to keep everybody locked down, and they want to, you know, do universal mail-in voting. And you kind of do the math on all that, Michael, and then right away you see, well, this is obviously their election strategy. So what we're talking about here is really an election strategy for the Democrats, because they don't have policy. What do you say to that?
It's great that you added the policy part in, because I was just thinking the same thing. I mean, really, we've gotten to the point where we have one movement and one party, the conservative movement and the Republican Party, less so, but that are largely looking for creative and innovative and successful policy solutions that they can offer the American people in the hopes of winning their vote. Mm-hmm. We have another party and movement in the radical progressive, increasingly Marxist ideology, which increasingly is running the Democrat Party, which really would prefer not to talk about any policies, but is very good at the machinations of the electoral process, and whether that's motivating people to go do something they wouldn't do in voting, or going out on the street and breaking things, or whether it's actually fraudulently engaged in electoral interference. I don't want to say this comprehensively, because there's probably some notable exceptions, but when I look at the fraud cases over the last few years, you know, there's just a very sizable number of Democrats and Democrats attached to the Democrat machine, including, you know, in Philadelphia, a former congressman here has just been convicted of ballot tampering, and individuals in the Philadelphia Democrat Party that had literally gone into a voting booth and just sat there voting repeatedly until they couldn't vote any longer.
Well, this is a story that is not going to go away. And in fact, I would suggest to you that we'll be talking about this more and more just ahead, because we're just, well, Michael points out just a moment ago, we're just at the tip of the iceberg now. I mean, this thing has just opened up, and I kind of get a feeling or a sense like the floodgates have just opened up between now and November 3rd. And of course, we'll see what happens. But as you're hearing a lot of reports out there now, they're predicting there will be no winner November 3rd or November 4th, for that matter. They're talking about taking it outward. You can see what's happening here, people. This is the most volatile time. And yet, you know, we're now questioning our election. It's really unconscionable. We're having these dialogues to the level that we have to have them, but it's where we find ourselves right now. Listen, what we want to talk to you about next is the Senate. The Senate is very, very, and you listen, there are no guarantees that the Republicans are going to be able to retain the Senate, quite frankly. In fact, there are many different reports on this that the Democrats have picked up some momentum, I hate to say to you. And so we need to peel that back a little bit, too, because you realize had they not controlled the Senate, you realize we would have lost three conservative Supreme Court justices potentially here. And so, you know, there's a lot more to talk about that as well. Well, let me tell you as well, you're listening to Viewpoint Presents here and want to remind you here that we're on every Sunday. You catch this on America Out Loud Talk Radio now, and you catch it at 11 a.m. and there's an encore later in the day at 7 p.m. Eastern time now. Eastern time, but you can hear us anywhere in the country and around the world for that matter on iHeartRadio. We have great apps, by the way, Apple, Android, or Alexa as well. There are many. We have world-class media player, and we're on a lot of networks. So there's lots of different ways to listen to us. So again, invite you in Sunday. Have Sunday morning coffee with us. 10 o'clock is Viewpoint this Sunday, where we get many of the leaders around the globe and people. It's just an amazing 2 hours of talk radio. And that's at 10 to 11. And then 11 to 12 is my dear colleague here, Michael Johns, and myself here. So 10 to 12 Sunday, and then 6 to 8 later in the day. All the shows go to podcast around 2:30 Sunday afternoon, actually. So we thank you always for helping us with that. And we're going to take a quick pause, be back and try to peel the Senate a little bit so we're all a little more informed on what the stakes are there. More Viewpoint Presents in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
What if a new treatment backed by 17,000 scientific articles was proven to extend our lifespan, protect against terrible diseases like cancer, heart disease, and dementia, make us more attractive and thinner, feel calmer and happier, and boost energy levels, memory, and performance? What would you pay for even the smallest dose of this treatment? Well, the good news is you don't have to pay anything, because these are just some of the benefits of a full night of quality sleep. If you're one of the millions of Americans who need better quality sleep, the time to change is now. Until now, most sleep aids haven't worked, but a new, easy-to-swallow sleep gel invented by the leading nutrition company, Healthy Cell, is designed to support all four stages of human sleep to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake up refreshed. It's called REM Sleep. To get a free two-night supply of REM Sleep, visit healthycell.com/sleep. That's healthy, CELL.com/sleep.
American Democracy in Action. Viewpoint presents Election 2020.
Well, we've been talking about so much on the program here, and one of the most important things you've got to worry about is Congress. I mean, you've got to worry about the House and the Senate both. And of course, there are two big questions here, and you know what they are, my friends. One is, can we take the House back? Can conservatives, flip the House, is what we call it, and can they retain the Senate? Well, not up next, let's talk about the Senate a little bit and give you a little perspective on what's happening here. As we join you back here, Michael, one of the things I want to point out right now, first up front, is this. I mean, you've got here, Democrats basically need a gain or a net gain, really, of three seats to flip the Senate. Well, we said flip the House, it'd be flipping the Senate if they win the White House. But the vice president, everybody should understand, breaks the tie in the Senate, as always the case. And so it would actually be four seats if President Trump wins re-election. Can they do it, do you think? Can they do it?
Absolutely, they can do it. There are a number of very contentious seats. One of the disadvantages Republicans face in 2020 is the fact that you have 33 seats up total. 23 of those are GOP incumbents defending their seats, and only 12 are Democrats.
That's the problem right there.
So we have much more downside potential than Democrats do In this. But I think if you actually, you know, dive into it, you start to see a good number of, well, at least a few opportunities to unseat incumbent Democrats. I think Michigan's an opportunity. I think Alabama's an opportunity. And when you look at, you know, Republican seats, there's a lion's share of those that are at stake that I would say are solidly in Republican hands and likely to go considerably for the president. Yeah. That's all hugely positive. And then you sort of dive down to, I guess, what I would say are maybe five races here that I think are really broadly considered toss-ups. You have the Purdue seat in Georgia. Joni Ernst in Iowa, Susan Collins in Maine, Danes in Montana, and Tillis in North Carolina. Some of those wouldn't historically have been contested, but they kind of represent shifting demographics. North Carolina and Georgia were never historically really swing states, have increasingly become that. I do think importantly, the every one of these candidates is going to benefit from the level of enthusiasm that Trump voters have, meaning sometimes you have a presidential candidate at the top of the ticket that is not inspiring voter turnout. There's zero risk of that happening here in 2020. And I think most believe that the Senate confirmation process, which I'm sure is going to be a little bit of a circus, at least here in the next few weeks, will remind Republican-leaning Republican voters and Republican-leaning independents of the importance of maintaining this. I mean, the judgeships have become, as we've talked about, so crucially important.
Well, and this latest Supreme Court pick is certainly reminding all Americans the importance of the Senate, because without the Senate to be in the hands of conservatives, you would not have potentially now the third Supreme Court justice. That's a major switch of our nation, a historical moment in time for sure. Let me tell you what I'm seeing here. You know when I speak about 538-2020, right? The ABC there. And so they're saying the Democrats are slightly favored, or could say flavored, to win the Senate. And they say they have an 80% chance of holding between 47 and 54 seats. But they're saying they slightly favor them. Is that more just a bias on their end, or are they doing
I think that's pretty conventional wisdom. I don't think there's any aberration in that polling. I think if you go through in the major polling, you'd find that's conventional wisdom on the national ones. Now, when you break down into congressional races and Senate races, one of the challenges is that these polls end up often being done by local colleges. And I'm not disparaging their polling abilities, but they probably have considerably less experience and exposure to the nuances of it than some of the larger agencies do. And we know how inaccurate some of the larger ones are. I know we have limited time, so I want to just kind of say I've taken a real close look, and I've been monitoring for a long time. I think it's crucial to the messaging and to understanding what's going on politically in the country about what's on the mind of these voters. So when they do go to vote on these Senate races, what are they concerned about? There's a few intriguing things here. One is that for all of the talk of the pandemic and coronavirus, and as devastating as it's been to human life and people's disruption of their work and social lives, it's fourth down on the list of voter priorities right now. The economy remains far and away the single most important issue confronting voters, at 79% of whom consider it the top issue. That's very good news for Republicans, because voters also consider the economy by a 49-40 statistic to be their favored issue. Economy, and surprisingly gun policy, which I think shows a strong support for the Second Amendment, terrorism, and law enforcement and criminal justice are strong issues for Republicans. For Democrats, climate change, which is not a top 10 issue for voters this
healthcare,
year.
Healthcare.
Abortion and healthcare. Mm-hmm. On healthcare, voters favored by a 51-37 percentage of the Democrats on that issue. And I think that really represents a challenge that we need to take seriously, that Obamacare itself is no solution it's flawed in so many ways. Right. But the replacement plan is so crucial. We need to be
Let me ask you about that right now, because I don't see any replacement plan. That's one of the biggest complaints for the right.
Well, go back. You'll remember the famous Senate vote where John McCain famously gave the down thumb signal and killed it off after he had campaigned, of course, in Arizona saying that he would repeal. But that was really based in everyone's mind on a repeal and replace. Mm-hmm. And of course, our Tea Party movement kind of led the charge against it. It was an immensely unpopular plan, but the replacement is key. So individuals, as they become reemployed, as we get through this pandemic and they're able to pick private insurance back up, that's going to solve a lot of the issues. The president, to his great credit, has defended Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. People receiving any one of those three two which are healthcare programs, have, I think, very little to worry about. That's very positive, whereas Biden has threatened to cut those. The VA program, I think, continues to improve on the president's watch. So if you're in the VA, that's positive. I think these numbers reflect the fact that there's this niche of Americans out there, particularly low and some middle-income workers without health insurance plans, that are continuing to confront difficulties obtaining affordable plans in the private marketplace. And that's the issue that I think conservatives and Republicans need to really be putting some serious intellectual energy into.
Well, there's a lot of noise out there right now. And one thing you talk about the issues there and healthcare being one that is so unsettled in our country. But the abortion one has been brought front and center with this justice now with Supreme Court, with the death of Ginsburg, you know, and so that kind of puts a different perspective.
It's third on the issue of voter concerns: economy, health care, and then SCOTUS, then coronavirus, violent crime, foreign policy, gun policy. Interesting of what's not on there. There seems to be a real falling off of concerns on environmental and climate issues. Yeah. The deficit is not listed as a top concern.
None of those are in the top 10. None of those are. Yeah. And neither people is COVID as well.
Well, and there's so much potential crossover here, meaning, you know, as you address coronavirus, you're also addressing the economy, obviously, and you're also addressing healthcare. As you improve healthcare, you're addressing the pandemic. You know, some of these are almost multi-category voter themes.
They are. Yeah, they are. All right. Well, what we will do is we will dive more into the Senate and over the next couple of weeks. And Michael talks about this all the time. And he and I, we talk off mic, but we will dive more into some of these races. You know, the five we were just talking about that are questionable, that the Republicans are going to have to watch and be careful. Perdue, Ernst, Collins, Daines, and Tillis. Those are going to be very crucial seats in those states for the Senate. But we will talk much more about that, as well as the House and some of the congressional seats. Very interesting races there as well. A lot of the national conversation and the down ballots are going to be key as well. That's going to be front and center here, and how Trump does on this part of the race. And it's down ballot at that point. It could sweep some of these in. In fact, it could be a big part of this. Historically, that's what happens, and could impact the House and the Senate both, as well as local races. So that is the score here, my fellow Americans. And, you know, lots happening here. Big congratulations up front in the program there, as we talked about with Amy Coney Barrett, the next, hopefully, Supreme Court Justice. And it's going to be a battle now over the next few weeks here up until election. Got the debates coming as well. A lot happening there. Stay close here. Thank you for being on the mission here. It's time to get involved and get loud.